Good afternoon. One of the perks of being in God's family and part of his way of life is that we not only get to learn about his children from times gone by, but we also get to think about the people that we're going to meet, because we know that God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. And so when he talks about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, he's talking about people that he knows and who will live again, and whom he will, whom we will meet in the world tomorrow, which is where we have our hope. There are people in the Bible that I would just love to meet, men and women, and I like learning about them from the Word of God. For me personally, of course, we'd all like to meet Jesus, and we will someday. I would like to have seen him as a man and hear him teach and see the effect that he had on people. But some of my favorites, I would like to meet Enoch, because there was something about Enoch that made God call him a friend, and we don't know much about him. And I'd like to know, I mean, if he's good enough to be a friend of God, I'd like to think I'd like him too. I'd like to meet Deborah, who was a very unusual human being. She was put in unique circumstances and came out as a leader because she had to. And served God beautifully. One of my favorites, though, and one of the most interesting characters in the entire scriptures is the man Samuel. Samuel, of course, has two books of the Bible named after him, so he's done okay in life. I have one book of the Bible named after me, so I'm not quite as good, but it'll give us an opening for the conversation. Of course, Samuel didn't know that there were two books of the Bible named after him, and he could not possibly have written 2 Samuel because he died in 1 Samuel. It says in the book of Chronicles that probably these books were written by Gad and by Nathan and by the prophet Samuel. But you know a lot about the story of Samuel. I just like the name, too. I wanted to name a son Samuel, but Taya said there's no way she was going around with a Sam Graham. So we have a David, same book of the Bible. Samuel is also mentioned in the Psalms. You just sang. Well, I did not consult with Mr. Horton, but the song Holy Mighty Majesty, Samuel also called upon God's name, and that's very significant because in the psalm that is taken from, there are only a few people mentioned who were able to call on God's name and God spoke to them. Samuel I'm mentioned in the psalms myself. In Psalm 37, it mentions Mark the perfect man. Although maybe it's talking about Mr. Scapura, I don't know. But it's actually negatived out by Psalm 130, where it says Mark iniquities. So I have two nicknames in the Bible, apparently, and it's kind of a wash by the time you're done. But Samuel was legitimately mentioned in the Psalms, and we sing about him to this day, just like we did today. He's also mentioned in the book of Hebrews 11, the faith chapter, as a man of strong faith, and he's mentioned in the book of Acts by the Apostle Peter as one of the first prophets. And Samuel had many titles. Samuel, probably more than anyone else in the scriptures, wore many, many hats, maybe with the possible exception of Jesus Christ himself. But Samuel was a judge. He was a judge of Israel. He was a Levite. He was a kingmaker. He was a prophet. He was a priest. He served Eli, and he offered sacrifices, and he represented the nation before God. He was a priest. He was a Nazirite. So he's one of the few people who we have some idea of what his hair looked like. There was a lot of it. No razor touched his head during his lifetime. He was a Nazirite. This is a little scurrilous, but he's the only ghost mentioned in the Bible. Of course, that's a whole other topic, and I'd be happy to talk about it over snacks after services. But we won't be touching on that today. But Samuel had all these different titles. And you know very well that the story of Samuel is in the book of 1 Samuel. So let's turn there now. And because this is some of the most compelling reading, I mean, you can't believe some of the stuff that's in the book of Samuel. It would be hard for a novelist to make up anything as juicy as is in the first book of Samuel. It's just incredible. when it starts, it says there was a certain man from Ramathaim, a Zuphite, from the hill country of Ephraim. And so this man is presented as an Ephraimite. His name is Elkanah, son of Jeroham, son of Elihu, and it gives his genealogy. Well, this is important because in the book of 1 Chronicles, we get this same genealogy, but the genealogy does not come from the line of Ephraim because Elkanah was a Levite. And that's how we know that Samuel was a Levite. This is in 1 Chronicles 6. And this isn't the only place in the Bible where you see a Levite living with another tribe of people, particularly in times when the government was a little bit loosely organized. The Levites would scatter and live in different communities and would serve God and the people wherever they were. In Judges 17:7, there's a Levite mentioned living with the tribe of Benjamin, and he's called a Benjaminite, but he is a Levite. So Samuel was a Levite. And talk about drama. This man had two wives. Drama enough, right? And he one wife had children, Peninnah. The second wife, Hannah, had no children. And so there was drama there. It sounds a little bit like Hagar and Sarah. It seems to echo that. This man was very devout, and in verse 3, year after year, he went up from his town to worship and sacrifice to the Lord Almighty at Shiloh, where Hophni and Phinehas, the two sons of Eli, were priests of the Lord. And actually, you either know this story, or you'll read it someday. I don't have to go through the whole story. Hannah appealed to the Lord and prayed before God for a son, and God gave her a son. And the son, she named Samuel. And she said, and it's covered multiple times here. I mean, you look at all these verses, and there are many verses in this first chapter that talk about asking God and receiving from God, and Hannah asking for a son, and Hannah giving this son to the priests to grow up and serve them. And the root that this comes from is Sha'al, which is a Hebrew root, which means asked. Now, the name Samuel has other etymologies also. Some people say it means the name of God. It's a fairly vague assembly of vowels and consonants, but asked seems to be the root, and Hannah did ask. What's fascinating about this is that if Samuel had a character who is pitted against him in this whole story, it would be the man we know as Saul, and the name Saul comes from the same root. Their names both come from the same Hebrew root, both Saul and Samuel. So that's a little bit of irony there. Well, as you know, Hannah did receive a son, and she had been longing for years to have a son, so it seems strange to us that she would give him up. She did not raise her son. Instead, she gave him to a man who had two of the worst sons in Israel, who had probably some of the worst child-rearing cred in the book of the Bible. His sons eventually ended up being killed because of their sins, and this is the family that Hannah gave her son to be raised by. So you can be sure that she visited him fairly frequently, and it says she brought him clothes. She brought him little clothes, it says, and I bet the clothes got bigger and bigger as time went by. But Samuel, of course, was raised in the house of the high priest by Eli and lived in the same house as his wicked sons. And it's a poignant story because in chapter 2, in verse 18, it talks about Samuel ministering before the Lord. And here it is, the boy wearing a linen ephod. And in verse 19, each year his mother made him a little robe and took it to him when she went up with her husband to offer the animal sacrifice. So his mother got to see him once a year. It was a very strange childhood. And when Samuel did tell him, then Eli said in verse 17 of chapter 3, verse 18, so Samuel told him everything, hiding nothing from him. And Eli said, he is the Lord. Let him do what is good in his eyes. And then we see something happening. Samuel grew up. And in verses 19 and further, the Lord was with Samuel as he grew up, and he let none of his words fall to the ground. What an extraordinary phrase. In other words, the things that Samuel said, people listened to, including God. And God backed up Samuel. That's what that means, that he let none of his words fall to the ground. And all Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, recognized when Samuel stood next to Eli, they knew who was who. they recognized that Samuel was recognized, it says here, attested, as a prophet of the Lord. The Lord continued to appear at Shiloh, and there he revealed himself to Samuel through his word. And Samuel's word came to all Israel. What an unusual young man to grow up and have all of Israel paying attention to him and hanging on his every word, because they knew that God backed him up. Well, then comes a story that you just can't believe, and you just can't believe it's in the Bible. The Philistines capture the Ark of the Covenant. I'm not going to go into this in great detail. Eli was killed, of course, and at this point, and his sons died also, and the Ark went into captivity, and the Philistines possessed it. And then in chapter 5, and this story is too good to be able to make up, and it's such an embarrassing story in the Bible that the Jews, in olden times at least, wouldn't even read the words out loud. There were certain words they substituted, because what God did to the Philistines was he gave them a plague, and please read this, I'm not making this up, he gave them a plague of mice, bad enough, all right? But then he gave them a plague of a word that can only be translated as hemorrhoids. He gave them terrible hemorrhoids, and the original Hebrew word means hemorrhoid. The Septuagint gets around it by calling it a disease of the rear end in Greek. But their punishment was, okay, the ark returned and the Philistines said, and please read this story. Like I said, I am not making it up. The Philistines said, how can we get rid of this terrible plague? Both of them. But you know that the mice were not the one they were worried about. And the word was given to them that they had to return the ark along with 5 golden mice and 5 golden hemorrhoids. How do you do that? I mean, how would you recognize a golden hemorrhoid if you saw one? And because of the way that the wording is, there was one rabbi who was writing about it, and he said, I just cannot believe God would stoop to this toilet humor. But what he was doing was humiliating the Philistines at this point. And it is thought that rather than, and there's certain parts of the Hebrew that for people who know what they're reading and understand it, that it gives the concept that what they had to make, the mice part was fairly easy, but what they ended up was making 5 rear ends and bringing them back. And you can look into that. It's real. It's in the Bible. And thank goodness, by chapter 7, it's over with, and we're done with the hemorrhoids. Because it really did happen. The ark made its way to Kiriath Jearim, and in verse 21 of chapter 6, it says, then they sent messengers to the people of Kiriath Jearim, the people of the town, saying, the Philistines have returned the ark of the Lord. Come down and take it up to your place. And so they did. They took it to a house of a man named Abinadab and consecrated his son Eleazar as a person to guard it. Now, the ark, of course, symbolized the nation of Israel. It symbolized their relationship with God. It symbolized all that God had done for them. I don't think that the ark had the special kind of powers that you see in the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark. But we do know that the ark was something on earth that meant something to God, and he always knew where it was. And it did mean something, and so what you read about in chapter 7 is another title for the prophet Samuel, because what happens is the Philistines, they bring the ark, they have an assembly, and they bring the ark up to Mizpah. And in verse 7, when they did a rotation, he went to Bethel, he went to Gilgal, and he went to Mizpah, and he would set up court there, and he would judge things for the Israelites. He would give rulings and make decisions and help them implement things to make their form of government run smoothly. But one of the things we find out about Samuel is that wherever he is, wherever someone comes to contact him, there seems to be a resident group of prophets living in that place. And so there's reason to think that Samuel had establishments, Bethel, Gilgal, Mizpah, and Ramah. And I know in the old days, of course, it fit very well in with our church's situation back up till the mid-70s when we had three campuses. And people said, well, see, Samuel had campuses too. And actually, you know, we don't have campuses anymore as such, but Sammy really did. He really did have establishments where prophets were. And these prophets prophesied. And Mr. Thomas read the story when he was talking about the Holy Spirit on the day of Pentecost. One of the things that these prophets did, and that seems to have been very important to Samuel, and actually it's a theme that carries on not just during his life, but in the legacy that he left, is that these prophets were also musicians. And music, especially organized group ensemble music, was not a very common thing in those days. I mean, you traveled. There weren't recordings. You couldn't drag out your phone and your earbuds and listen to anything. You either made the music yourself, as David did, or you could go up to one of these central places where Samuel seems to have organized temple music without a temple. And I'll show you why I use that phrase later on. So Samuel had these bases. Now, Samuel, as you know, grew up in a dysfunctional family. Who knows what life would have been like if he'd stayed with his mother? He certainly wouldn't have been the leader of Israel. He would have grown up possibly to be a Levite servant like his father was. But in chapter 8, the chickens come home to roost, so to speak. When Samuel grew old, he appointed his sons as judges for Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second was Abijah, and they served at Beersheba. But just like his stepfather, Samuel was good at many things, but he either, you know, it doesn't mention who his wife was. We don't know anything about her. But we do know that Samuel's way of life didn't take root in his children. Now, I don't necessarily blame Samuel for that, because I know many, many fine people whose godly way of life does not take root in their children, no matter how their children are raised. But these sons tried to act like God's way of life was in them. They tried to get jobs as sons of Samuel, and this ended up being a problem, because in verse 3, his sons did not walk in his ways, and so they did the job, but they turned aside after dishonest gain and accepted bribes and perverted justice. They took money for favors, and they'd seen this before in the sons of Eli. So we talk about Israel asking for a king, but there was a good reason for it. They were very disappointed because Samuel looked like he was going to be the beginning of a long, glorious reign of God's leaders, and in one generation, it didn't turn out that way. So in verse 4, all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. They came to him, which was his headquarters, and they said to him, "You're old. Your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as the other nations have." And this is such a well-known story that we'll leave it alone. Except to point out that Saul was the same root name as Samuel, that they had that kind of thing in common. And Saul is an interesting character in his own right. He was a humble, unschooled, he was a backwoods type person, uncultured, and you read about that in verse 9, and it's very funny. He comes to Samuel, and Samuel anoint him, and Samuel appoints him to be the next king. But before this could happen, God had to actually change Saul's heart. And in chapter 10 and verse 9, after all this had happened, after Saul was predestined to be king by Samuel and the prophets, but Israel didn't know it yet. As Saul turned to leave Samuel, God changed Saul's heart, and all these signs were fulfilled that day. Well, then guess what happens? When they arrived at Gibeah, a procession of prophets met him, and Samuel had said this will happen. And one of the reasons Samuel said this would happen was Samuel probably sent them. This was his band. He sent them out. And it had to do with the Holy Spirit, with Saul receiving a spirit from God at this point. In verse 11, when all those who had formerly known him, he started doing karaoke with the band. He couldn't help himself. They were so good and so infectious, and the Spirit of God, it says, was on him in power, and he could do nothing at that point to resist prophesying. And so he sang with them. And this became a story. I mean, okay, news didn't travel as fast as some things, but it says that this traveled all over Israel, and it became a joke. And the punchline of the joke is here, but I don't get the joke. And I wonder if you do, you can explain it to me. Here's the setup in verse 11. Here, they ask each other, what is this that has happened to the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets? Okay, that's the setup for the joke. And the punchline is, a man who lived there answered, and who is their father? I don't get it. I don't know if you do, but it says, so it became a saying, is Saul also among the prophets? I don't know if I'm missing some vocabulary here that talks about the prophets being someone's son, and they say, well, who's Saul's father? I mean, you know, there's the joke, it kind of reminds me of the one that's in Mary Poppins about, I once knew a man with a wooden leg named Smith, and the punchline is, what was the name of his other leg? Well, this is a punchline for something, and the reason we know it's a punchline is when a king, Saul was still in touch, and he was kind of saying, I haven't lost it, folks. There's still something going on here. God is still the leader of this community, even though you've asked for a king. Well, Saul, well, let's go through a lot of time. In chapter 13, Saul was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned over Israel 40 years. So everything that happens from now till then, you know, that's 40 years. We're just going to zip through. And you know very well that Saul disappointed Samuel, and God rejected Saul in chapter 15. There's that story. And then chapter 16, Samuel anoints David. And this was a gift from God to Samuel, too. It wasn't just Samuel doing something for David, but you know the miraculous story about Samuel going up to the house of Jesse in chapter 16 to anoint a new king. And he looked at all the men, the seven sons of Jesse, and he said, I don't see the king here. You must have another son. Well, they wondered about that, of course, because they said, we do. He's out with the sheep. And Samuel said, bring him in. And I always wonder what went through David's mind at that point when he said, Samuel has just shown up and he wants you. And, you know, David was probably a teenager at this point, and he was probably terrified. But he went and stood before Samuel, and something happened there. It just says that Samuel could tell that he was, in verse 12, he sent and had him brought in. He was ruddy and had a fine appearance and handsome features. And the Lord said, rise and anoint him. He is the one. So Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the presence of his brothers, operating as both a priest and a kingmaker. And from that day on, the Spirit of the Lord came upon David in power. Samuel then went back to Ramah, sort of in retirement, where his home was. Well, then you know the story of David, and we're not going to touch on that very much. David kills Goliath. David becomes a part of Saul's household. David marries Saul's daughter, and this was mentioned recently in a sermon, this story about David fleeing from Saul. So let's jump to chapter 19, and we see that, let's start at verse 11, Saul sent men to David's house to watch it and to kill him in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, warned him, if you don't run for your life tonight, tomorrow you'll be killed. So she favored her husband over her father. She saved his life. Michal let David down through a window and he fled and escaped. And then Michal faked David's body in the bed. In the movies they do it with a pillow and a wig or something. The head, it says, was made of some goat's hair. So she did her work pretty thoroughly. Well, Saul was angry, and that's their story. But verse 18 is what we want to look at. When David had fled and made his escape, he went to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And, of course, Ramah was Samuel's home. And we're near the end of Samuel's very long and distinguished life of service at this point. And Samuel could be retired there, but instead he used this as a time to serve God and to set up a legacy, not necessarily just of Samuel, but a legacy for God, an organization for God that would extend far into the future. One of the reasons that we think that Saul taught in these places where he lived, you can see... Well, let's read in verse 18. When David had fled and made his escape, he went to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. Then he and Samuel went to Naioth and stayed there. Naioth just means huts. So Naioth was a little place, a little housing development near Ramah that Samuel had invested in. And it was a place where, it could have been a place where he housed his prophets, because verse 19, word came to Saul, David is at Naioth in Ramah. So he sent men to capture him. But when he got there, he saw a group of prophets prophesying with Samuel standing there as their leader. The Spirit of God came upon Saul's men, and they also prophesied. Saul was told about it, and he sent more men, and they prophesied too. Now, before we reach the third time, hold your finger there, and let's turn to Acts, the book of Acts. I think I'll have to find it. I don't think I wrote it down, but it's early in the book of Acts where Peter is preaching. So it's probably about Acts 5. Or 4 or 3. Well, we could find it, but in the sermon, I'm sorry I didn't write this down, but in the sermon, Peter uses the phrase that the prophets, beginning with Samuel, have spoken of Jesus Christ. We can look that up after services. But his point is that Samuel spoke to the people he taught about Jesus Christ coming. He was one of the first prophets, and that's the only way that we know about that was from what Peter said, so there must have been a tradition of that. So here's a group of prophets that Samuel is working with and apparently taught them about God's way of life. Okay, then in verse 21, Saul sent men a third time, and they also prophesied. Finally, he said, I'm going to do this. And he himself left for Ramah, went to the great cistern at Sekou, and he says, where's Samuel and David? And they said, over his father. And Amasai, Ahimoth, Elkanah, Zophai, Nahath, Eliab, Zeroham, Elkanah, and then Samuel, his son. Could Samuel have been the youngest, the way David was the youngest of many sons? Maybe Samuel and David identified because of that. The sons of Samuel, just as in the book of 1 Samuel, are Joel the firstborn and Abijah the second son. So this is definitely the same man. It's not just the same name appearing. It's definitely the same lineage. And he was a Levite. Now, from there, we jump to the temple musicians. And in verse 31, these are the men David put in charge of the music in the house of the Lord after the ark came to rest there. They ministered with music before the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, until Solomon built the temple of the Lord in Israel. They performed their duties according to the regulations laid down for them. And when Solomon dedicated that temple, this organization is still in effect. And the people that David set up are still in effect. But hold your place there. And I want to turn to 1 Chronicles 9, where we read something very interesting. 1 Chronicles 9 and verse 22. This is talking about the gatekeepers and the Levites and the priests and other people. This is talking about just workers in the temple, not people who necessarily have to have any particular talent. These are people who open gates. These are people who carry things. These are people who light fires, whatever is done. And in verse 22, altogether, those chosen, we don't even have to read who they were. They're just people who worked there. But they were chosen in advance. They were chosen to be gatekeepers at the thresholds numbered 212. They were registered by genealogy in their villages. The gatekeepers had been assigned to their positions of trust by David and Samuel the seer. This was a system that was set up by David and Samuel together. And the only time that they spent a lot of time together was at Naioth when David was fleeing. So it's logical to conclude that they used their time very well, that those prophets singing and stalling Saul were there so God's work could be done through Samuel and David, so that they could plan things together. And this system of gatekeepers and musicians and things lasted for as long as the temple lasted, as in the nation of Israel. When you go back to chapter 6, and it talks about the temple musicians, it only mentions David. It doesn't mention Samuel. And why? Why could they name the gatekeepers but not the musicians? Well, anybody can keep a gate. I could keep a gate. Not everybody could be a musician. And so they had to find out who could actually do it. Before they appointed them, I mean, no, I won't name names, but what if we appointed just randomly the musicians? It wouldn't work. Gatekeepers, it might work. A snack table, it wouldn't work. You want to make sure that the people on snack table are qualified, good people, you know? musicians is that way too. You don't know until you see what people can do. And so this was decided by David later. But here's something heartwarming. When David put together the organization, there were three main men. And here are the men who served together with their sons. I'm in verse 33. From the Kohathites, Heman the musician. Then jump down to verse 39. Heman's associate Asaph, who served at his right hand. So this was another one of them. And then in verse 44, there's a man named Ethan. And these men, Heman, Asaph, and Ethan, set up a temple service that lasted for a long time. So long, and Asaph was a composer. Asaph wrote quite a number of our psalms, I think 12. And the musicians in the temple came to be known as the sons of Asaph. So the system that David and Samuel set up lasted for a while. But notice back in verse 33. Here were the men who served together with their sons from the Kohathites. Heman, the musician, the son of Joel, the son of Samuel. Heman was Samuel's grandson. So Samuel not only got to organize the temple service, but his family got to supervise the music. And this was probably a passion of Samuel's. You know, he couldn't, maybe he couldn't do it himself, but this was a legacy that he left. There's so much more. He's such a deep, rich life that this man had led. And as I said, there's things we don't know about him that we will find out when we meet him in the world tomorrow. He is mentioned in Hebrews 11 as a man of extreme faith. And he comes off as a bit of a crab in the books of the Bible that we read. But apparently he was a very warm-hearted, passionate man who wanted to serve God with all his being. You know, I think of the prophet Elijah. When you read about what Elijah did in the books in the Old Testament, Elijah comes off as a very sour, angry, crabby man. But when you read his legacy in the New Testament, it says that he turned the hearts of fathers to children and children to fathers. And that's what a man very much like him will do in the world tomorrow. Well, Samuel was the same way. He may have come off one way, but his legacy helps us to judge him as a person who deeply felt the need to serve God, set up an organization that lasted for 1,000 years, and his own, you know, even today we can read about him. Well, I hope you've enjoyed just learning a few details about a person that you thought you knew a lot about. And as I said, together we can sit with Samuel in the world tomorrow and find out the rest of the story.